Hello and welcome to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Mercifully and finally, we have made it to NFL Draft Week. No more risers and fallers, no more anonymous scouts quotes. Now, we did a big draft preview last week with Eric Edholm of Yahoo Sports. You can check that out. This week, part two of our draft preview is with Matt Miller, the NFL Draft Scout on Twitter. If you watch ESPN, you have seen and heard a lot from Matt over the last couple of months. He does a great job breaking down the prospects. We'll hit on a couple of the top storylines for this week's draft with Matt, and then we'll jump ahead to the 2022 draft class. Who are the players you can already pencil into the top of your draft boards for next year? What does the quarterback class look like heading into the 2021 college football season? What players have a chance to make a big jump in 2021 after abbreviated or injury loss seasons in 2020? After that, my friend Nicole Auerbach from The Athletic joins me to chat about the most evergreen topic in college football, playoff expansion. The CFP caused a bit of a stir last week when, in a news release, it mentioned that the commissioners who run the show were dipping a toe into expanded playoff models. What does it mean? Is expansion coming sooner rather than later? What exactly does that mean? What is sooner? What is later? Nicole and I try to read the tea leaves and have a little fun with models. Thanks for listening to the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast. You can find us at appodcast.com and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere you like to get your podcast. If you like what you hear, give us a good review and a good rating. Subscribe, please, too. It helps college football fans find us, and it helps us find more college football fans. If you'd like to email the show, send questions and comments to AP Top 25 Mailbag. That's AP Top 25 Mailbag, the numbers 25, at gmail.com. AP Top 25 Mailbag at gmail.com. And away we go. Joining me this week on the podcast is Matt Miller, founder of The Draft Scout and ESPN NFL Draft Analyst. Matt, thanks so much. I know you are working and working and working and working and grinding these days, so I really appreciate you squeezing us in to talk some draft both this year and next year.
Yeah, no, it's great to be on with you. Like you said, it's a crazy time of year, you know, as we sit here less than a week before the draft, and the action never stops. So it's like you got one eye on your phone all the time, one eye usually on a laptop, and trying to keep track of the conversation you're having at the same time.
Yeah, Matt just does a tremendous job here, and I'm really, he's gotten a lot of interesting breaks over the last couple of years. I won't go deep into your career, but I know hit a little bump there with Bleacher Report, but we're all really happy to see you go out on your own with the Draft Scout. You guys can sign up for that. You can follow Matt at NFL Draft Scout on Twitter and dive into his contact, and of course also being used on ESPN, which is where you've really been used a ton over the last couple of weeks. I've really enjoyed watching you on GetUp and every other place they got you on there. So let's start with this. Let's start a little bit with, because by the time most people listen to this podcast, the draft will maybe be a day away. Maybe even the draft has started because it's later in the week. So I want to hit a little bit on this as you're sort of putting a bow on, like, you're down the stretch, right? We're down the home stretch of 2021. Let's hit on just like the highlight topics. Highlight topic being, is San Francisco going to draft Matt Jones? Go.
Yes, they are. Okay. I really do. I did something earlier. It's Friday, April 23rd when you and I are talking. And I did something earlier this week. I text five people that I consider to be very plugged into the NFL, reporters, you know, decision makers who've been around for a long time. I text five people one question. I said, what percent confident are you that Mac Jones will be the pick? Everyone, except for one person, everyone replied over 99%.
Okay.
And so, like, John Lynch has not told me who they're going to draft. Kyle Shanahan has not told me who they're going to draft. But there are certain people that you trust, right? And people who've been doing this a lot longer than me, and people who are more plugged in than I will ever be. And when they say, hey, it's 99%, it's going to be Mac Jones, I believe them.
Okay. So do you think we will get five quarterbacks in the top 10?
Yes,
okay.
I do. I think after trades, I do. I think that will happen. Someone will come up, whether it's Denver, whether it's New England, whether it's Chicago. I don't think Chicago will, maybe Washington. But I do think we'll get, you know, we'll get those five quarterbacks. It's just the blueprint is so set right now to have that rookie quarterback under 5 years of roster control, to steal a term for baseball. It's just smart. It's smart to build that way. And we're even seeing teams miss on that guy and not be fired. You know, I mean, Jason Light misses on Jameis Winston, goes and wins the Super Bowl. Steve Keim misses on Josh Rosen. It's okay, first pick overall. Kyler Murray the next year. So, and the Jets, you know, different regime, but they're getting a second chance with a quarterback. So I think that's what makes it interesting now, is it used to be you draft a quarterback and miss, you're out of here. Now it's like, well, as long as you don't trade up for him, you're probably going to be okay.
Okay. The mystery seemed to have been the 49ers, but really that's no mystery anymore. I think we've talked ourselves into mystery on the 49ers. Let me talk to you about the team that you are sort of most intrigued to watch how they handle their first or second round. Maybe a team with a ton of draft capital, like my Jets, for example. But who are the teams that you're interested to see how they maneuver?
Yeah, I think the Jets are obviously an interesting team. I'm a big fan of Joe Douglas's eye as an evaluator. I think the Miami Dolphins, though, to have pick 6, to have pick 18, they're back on the clock at 36. They're back on the clock at 50. So the Dolphins have 4 picks in the top 50, and this is a team that won 10 games last year. They don't have a lot of quote-unquote needs, and so I think that makes them a really interesting team, how they build around Tua, how they, you know, build if they're done with this offensive line, or if they want to continue to build it, what they do with the defense. So I'm a huge fan of what Brian Flores is doing down there, and how quickly they turn things around. So I think that makes them a really, really fun team to watch.
Okay, let me throw one more of 2021 at you. And I always like to get this from you guys who do such deep dives on the draft. I'll frame it to you this way. I don't want to go too deep, but let me frame it to you this way. What's the guy, give me a player who you kind of think, you look at and go, I think this guy could end up in the first round, even though we're not seeing a lot of him in the first round. And I understand that the difference between a guy who goes 25 overall and a guy who goes 40 overall is probably not that different. But give me a name of a guy you think could pop up in the first round that just hasn't been getting a lot of first round traction.
Yeah, and so this is always a hard question for me to answer, right? Because, like, I live in such a bubble of draft coverage. So I would say someone like, yeah, I don't think the casual fan knows who Jamin Davis from Kentucky is, the linebacker, who I think is fantastic. And so I think that's a name where people will, this happens every year, there will be linebackers, you know, like Zaven Collins, who won the Butkus and Bednarik Award, or Nagurski and Bednarik Awards. People will be like, well, wait, he was the best linebacker in college football. Why did this guy go ahead of him? And so, to me, those are like the names that more so surprise people. By the time, you know, the last week of April rolls around, I've done so many like mock draft exercises that there are no surprises anymore. You know, of like, oh, well, this, you know, last year Damon Arnett was the one where I was like, oh, goodness, like, didn't see this coming. Who could it be this year? There's not a player that jumps out to me of, oh, okay, didn't see that one coming. Maybe one of the other quarterbacks, you know, Kyle Trask or Davis Mills from Stanford, those would probably be the ones that you're like, okay, that's a pretty good surprise.
Okay. All right. So enough with 2021. Let's go to 2022, because I know you've already gone to 2022. And I'm going to start with this. When you start doing projections at this time of the year, basically a full year ahead of the draft, how you've been doing this for a few years, how often do you, when you go back and look, do you sense yourself, do you find yourself like seeing, oh, like I actually did pretty well here? Again, I don't know if you grade yourself in that way, but I guess my point would be, how often do the long range projections end up looking a fair amount like the short range projections when you get like, you know, a month or so away from the draft?
I think the thing is, I do go back and I try to grade myself or see what I got right, what I got wrong. To me, a mock draft is based so much on what I hear from people. So I more so use that of like, okay, who lied to me? Like who used me? You know, like you said, I've been doing this for, this will be my 11th draft doing this professionally. And so you try to find out, okay, who can I trust? Who led me wrong? And you do the same thing with your player rankings, because, you know, the scouting community is not big and we all talk and and try to figure things out together. And so you'll say like, okay, well, that person told me this about the player and I trusted it and it was wrong, or that person's opinion of this player was wrong. And so it's more so, yeah, I mean, I'm very a tough critic on myself. I try to go back and be like, why did I think Derrick Henry was not going to just do the same thing in the NFL that he did in college? You know, so like you beat yourself up over those things, or like, why did I not like overlook the fact that Russell Wilson and I are the same height and just remember how great he was at Wisconsin? You know, like, so that's what you beat yourself up about, is the things that you should have known better and didn't do, basically.
So, okay. So as you jot down your first round of 2022, and not even necessarily looking like, because I know a mock draft has to do with needs and things along those lines, but when you're just ranking the players, your first rankings, yeah, for 2022, who's on top?
He's going to start with Kayvon Thibodeau from Oregon, the pass rusher. He is just something special. And I know, you know, shortened season last year, but you can go back to 2019 and watch him at the end of the year. He's just, as a true freshman, he's just hurting people. He's 6'5", 250, amazing burst, excellent length. I mean, it's everything you could want in a pass rusher. I mean, he will be up there with the Chase Youngs and the Boses of the world in terms of a complete pass rush prospect.
Okay, I was going to ask you the comparison to Young and Bosa. What I, you know, listen, he's still a kid, Thibodeau. He looks like he could use a little more bulk. Is that something when you sort of, yeah, eye him and think like that will come as he gets older, or does it make him more of almost like a linebacker-ish as opposed to a defensive end?
I think he needs to bulk up a little bit, but I think his explosiveness is close to that, right? Like he's so quick off the ball. And I don't know if you remember this, but one of the biggest knocks on Nick Bosa was that he was a little slow off the ball. Now, obviously that turned out to be very wrong. He's been great in that regard. But I think that where Thibodeau doesn't have the size that those players had, he is so disruptive with his first step, with his quickness, with his length, that he's a different player, but I think he's going to be graded similarly as they were.
So look at him. And he, I think, falls in this category. But give me the next couple of guys, and also guys who you look at and think, if he didn't play, because we saw this year, this played out. We've talked about this for years. Like, what if, yeah, this guy didn't play and just sat out? Well, that happened this year with several very prominent players, and it looks like it didn't hurt their stock all that often. So who are the guys, we don't want to see them opt out, especially people who cover college football, but who are the guys you think, like,
right,
if he decided not to play in 2022, I don't think it would hurt his stock?
Yes, Thibodeau's one. Derek Stingley Jr. from LSU, the corner, is another. Like, yeah, he could just hang it up and be a top five pick. He's that good. There aren't, you know, at the receiver position, there are a lot of good receivers. There's not that player like a Ja'Marr Chase, you know, where you could just say, okay, he's good. Like, John Mechie at Alabama is really, really good. And Chris Olave and Garrett Wilson at Ohio State are really, really good. They're not to that level where they could just say, like, you know, I don't need to play next year, I'm that good. So I really think it's, oddly enough, it's two guys on defense who could probably be the ones where we know how good they are, and nothing's really going to change that. And quarterbacks next year, there's a lot more of them that you would consider draftable, but there's not that highly rated guy, you know. And even, you know, this year we knew Trevor Lawrence was going to be the number one pick for like 5 years. You know, there's no one that comes close to that. I think it'll be more of a, you know, like a Joe Burrow, Baker Mayfield type player who rises up next year, as opposed to a wire to wire number one quarterback.
Right. Well, let's just get into that since you opened the door there. So I think the layperson, you know, first person like me who doesn't watch like a scout or like a draft expert, looks at Spencer Rattler and Sam Howell and sort of thinks, okay, that's our top two-ish. You know, there's others, but that's our top two-ish. Mm-hmm. When you start your 2022 evaluations, are you starting with those two, or is there somebody else I'm missing?
Yeah, I think you start with the, you know, really I build up my list by obviously players I saw last year and liked, but then also like getting recommendations from scouts, getting recommendations from coaches, and even recommendations from agents of the players that they're really aggressively recruiting at this time of year. So I think Sam Howell at North Carolina is a good one. He's not going to wow you physically. You know, he's built a lot like Baker Mayfield at 6'1", 225. Keaton Slovis at USC, they have also two excellent wide receivers in Brew McCoy and Drake London. So they have some playmakers. He's going to be fun to watch. Jaden Daniels at Arizona State is an electric playmaker. He has to add some weight. He's just rail thin at this point. Those are the three that you probably start with. obviously Spencer Rattler at Oklahoma would be in that mix as well. Someone who, you know, just one season of tape so far, it was up and down. You know, he started the year poorly, finished the year very, very strong. So I think he's someone that you have to definitely have to keep an eye on, you know, as a guy that could rise up the board. But it's a deep class as well. There's, you know, Phil Yurkovich at Boston College is someone I really like, Desmond Ridder at Cincinnati, Carson Strong at Nevada. So it's going to be fun because this summer there's, I think I have 14 quarterbacks already listed that I get to watch film on this summer.
Yeah, let me talk to you about Ridder because he's an interesting one to me in that, you know, it just seems like you don't have quite as many. Though, you know, listen, I mean, I guess Trey Lance is of this category, right? He was not a big-time recruit out of college. And, in fact, a bunch of teams didn't want him to play quarterback, and that's how he ended up at North Dakota State. But
right. But
more and more we're seeing these quarterbacks go through the quarterback industrial complex like Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields, and they step into college at a very high level of refinement, and they, you know, are launched towards professional careers where basically, again, with Trevor and Justin are perfect examples of you saw them as freshmen and you just started counting the days. Okay, with Fields, I guess it was more sophomore because he got stuck behind Fromm his freshman year. But nonetheless, Desmond Ridder is not that kind of guy. Desmond Ridder is a guy who I think was a two or three star recruit, and it's been a slow burn. When you watch him and think of what he could be, I guess what kind of improvements have you seen, and what kind of improvements are you looking for coming 2022?
Yeah, last year was such an enigma. Like I find it not just with Ridder, but with everyone. Like how much did we put into last year? Because some of these guys were, you know, they found out a month before the season was going to happen that it was time to go play. So I think with Ridder, the biggest key will be, you know, cutting down on the turnovers. It did get better last year. The hope is, okay, going into senior year, we saw a big improvement in completion percentage last year. We saw a slight improvement in turnovers. Now he needs to take that next step. Like the completion percentage needs to hit 70. He needs to get the yards. You know, I want to say in 2019, he was under 2,200 yards. Like last year was probably around the same. Like he needs that blow up year where you're like, oh, okay, I see you. I see what you're doing out there. And to keep the turnovers down and then drive the yards and touchdowns up to where he puts himself in, you know, a situation where you can't overlook him. Like you can't ignore him basically.
So, and again, it's a year out, Matt, so I'm not going to hold you to this. Somebody else will on Twitter, but I am not going to hold you to this going out. But are we just at a point now where even there's a lot of development still to be had in these classes of quarterbacks? So I don't know if this quarterback class will look like next year's as, you know, with five guys who could be top 10 picks, or maybe is that just where we are now? So in other words, are you just, do you make the assumption now that, you know what, whether they're all as good as this year's class, by next year, there'll be four or five guys who will have separated themselves and NFL teams will decide, just as you said, this is the model and we're going to go get our guy. In other words, should we just be used to or expecting at this point three to five, maybe four or five first rounders and three to five going in the top half of the first round? Is that just the norm now?
It is. And I was having this conversation with Peter King, who's, you know, fantastic at this. And I had tweeted something about like, well, we'll see who the guy is next year. It doesn't look as strong right now. And like before I feel like I hit send on the tweet and he was calling me and he was like, you know, it's going to be the same way next year, just like it was last year and the year before that. Like teams will find guys, right? They will find that quarterback that gets driven up the board, whether it's a Desmond Ridder or Carson Strong or players like Sam Howell and Spencer Rattler, who we are aware of, right? And so I do think that's the new norm, is to have that many quarterbacks go early. And I think even what we've seen, you know, normally you would say, ah, man, like Sam Howell's too small. He'll be a second rounder. Doesn't matter anymore, you know, or like Matt Corral at Ole Miss.
There's a good one.
Ton of turnovers last year.
Right.
But God, he has a great arm, right? He has a huge arm. And he plays for Lane Kiffin. Like you tell me he couldn't blow up next year and be the Joe Burrow or Josh Allen that we're like, oh, okay. Like that dude's got some talent. So that's the fun part of it. It's also the frustrating part because everyone does want you to know May 2nd who that guy will be. And it's almost impossible to predict at this point.
Okay, let's get away from the quarterbacks for a second. We talked about Thibodeau from Oregon, who is a beast, and the type of player that you're not seeing in this year's draft, which is that you know, early first round edge rusher. Stingley, actually, let me get back to Stingley for a second here, because he didn't have a terrific, or at least
on paper.
Yeah, without grinding the tape, without being someone who's going to be going through the tape like you are, on paper and sort of as the more casual, like, I'm watching the game, how is he playing? It did not seem like he played that well last year. He also, I believe, was a little dinged up and in and out. So, but when you went back and looked at his, because his freshman year, he was spectacular. When you started digging into a little bit of his sophomore film, what did you see?
Yeah, sophomore film's like nothing to write home about, but it didn't need to be. As I said before, you asked, like, who's one guy who didn't need to play? Yeah, it's Derrick Stingley Jr. Like, I mean, scouts are already talking about just the traits, you know, that he's just so loaded up with potential. And his freshman year was good enough. He was the best defensive back in college his true freshman year. So it's like, that was good enough. You know, last year was, again, it was kind of an anomaly. He didn't have a pass rush in front of him. You know, he was, you know, some of their other DBs just didn't play as well as expected with Stevens and Vincent Jr. So I think that's why it's like, okay, he didn't have, you know, a great year, but it's not so much an indictment on him, if that makes sense.
No, that does. It does. And you're right. They were a defense in disarray last year. And as I know from doing, honestly, like from doing this job as college football writer for a long time, there are a lot of years, what it will happen is like doing the All-America team, right? All-America team is based on like production, sort of value, like, you know, easily digestible production. And then guys will get drafted very high, and you're like, wow, I wonder why that guy wasn't on our All-America team. And a lot of times it's just because his team failed around him. Darrell Revis was one of those guys who I think as was a wonderful prospect in college, but I don't know if people understood how good he was because he did not play on really great teams. And I think he got sort of lost in the shuffle there. And my guess is that was a little bit of what happened to Stingley last year in that it was a defense in disarray and people sort of like said, well, he can't possibly be playing as well because look how much the defense stinks.
Yeah, that happened to Josh Allen. Like, everyone knew who Josh was headed into that final year, and I went to Iowa to watch him play in his first game that year, and he was terrible. And people were crushing me. It's like, that's your guy? That's the quarterback you like? And it's like, name one player on his offense who'll play in the NFL. Like, one. And there weren't any, you know? And so it's like, we have to put everything in context, you know? And Revis is a great example of that. And I think Stingley Jr., especially when you're at corner, it's going to cover for so long, right? And we unfortunately live in an era where everything's like clipped and screenshotted. You know, it's like, oh, here's Derrick Stingley getting mossed by Kyle Pitts. Okay, everyone got mossed by Kyle Pitts. And what you didn't show was him covering him for 4 seconds, but no one being able to get to Kyle Trask. So I think that's the other thing is like when you get to the point of actually, like you said, grinding it out with these guys as opposed to, and no disrespect to people who have to do this, this is how I started, but when you're highlight scouting, you know, or clip scouting, it's a little bit harder to get a feel for who the player actually is.
No doubt. Okay, let's move away from those guys. And just, you know what, you have your list. Hit me up with the next few guys, non-quarterbacks, non-sort of obvious, hey, this guy doesn't even have to play, but guys you're super high on and really interested in seeing how they develop in 2022.
Yeah, you know what's crazy is Texas A&M is absolutely loaded next year. And maybe that shouldn't be a surprise given where they finished this past year, but their defensive lineman, DeMarvin Leal, is someone I've watched like 2.5 games probably and just fell in love with his traits to the point that one of my scouting assistants, I was like yelling across the hall to him like, oh my God, you got to watch this A&M D lineman because he's just so impactful at 6'4", 290. He can play inside. He can play outside. So he's someone who – I think we will begin talking about a lot more as the season gets going. And again, A&M is just absolutely loaded next year. I think the linebacker class is a lot of fun. Somebody who's probably sliding under the radar is Mike Rose at Iowa State.
Oh, yeah.
He's very big for the linebacker position, 6'4", 245. So a big, athletic, rangy linebacker. And I'm a huge fan of Matt Campbell, the head coach there. I think he gets his guys very ready for the NFL. And then the offensive line group is going to be really good next year. If you watch the Alabama spring game, you saw Evan Neal at left tackle. He basically eclipses the sun at 6'7", 360. Yeah. But he leads like a really good group of offensive linemen next year. You know, Zion Nelson at Miami is a very good player. Darian Kennard from Kentucky. I thought he was going to come out this year and didn't.
Yeah, I was surprised on him too.
Yeah, right. And I think that's the fun part for me is like looking at this list and being like, oh, wait, I thought he was going to come out last year and he didn't. And that makes it fun. You know, like Justin Ross comes back to Clemson. You don't forget about a player, but you know, they're kind of out of sight, out of mind. And then you're like, oh my God, like Justin Ross is back. This is great. You know, let's see Clemson try to, you know, take it a little bit farther next year.
Yeah. The Justin Ross one is really interesting too. Obviously. Now there's a guy who, again, we saw him as a freshman and another one who we saw him as a freshman and he was pretty spectacular, especially down the stretch of the college football playoff, where really, I mean, you could argue that he was even better than T. Higgins in the playoff, just burning Notre Dame and Alabama.
Right.
And then I guess you could say he slipped a little bit in his sophomore year. And of course, then he has the devastating injury last year where we're all kind of worried if it's going to be career ending, a neck injury. So what I would ask you on Ross is, you know, where are you looking for the improvements? Again, where are you looking for the game to grow here? Because there's certainly all kinds of tools. And in many ways, to me, again, he looked like in some ways a more athletic T. Higgins. Is that possible? You know?
No, you're right. And I think a more dynamic T. Higgins.
That's a good word. That's a good word for it.
Again, you know, 6'4", 205 with just an enormous catch radius. And you're right, like his production did dip a little bit in 2019. It felt like they were trying to run the ball a lot more that year, though. Like that was the Travis Etienne year. Like, okay, let's just turn around and hand the ball to Travis and it will work. And so they didn't have to throw the ball as much. And they did have, you know, Amari and T. And so they're spreading the ball around more. But I see Justin as like he does remind me of Mike Williams when he was there, of like you've just known this guy was going to be a dude for a long time. And then he has the injury, you know, that's you hate to see it. And then, you know, with, just hope that Justin has, you know, the comeback where he reminds people of who he was his freshman year. And I did hear that, you know, last year that he was cleared by the end of the season. I think it was just, you know, that with COVID and everything, it's like he didn't want to get back, didn't want to risk getting back out there. But you know, he has to be the most productive receiver returning in college football, I would think.
So the other position that often, you know, as we said, quarterbacks at the top, that's just sort of the way it is, right? We're always going to have a handful of quarterbacks. The best quarterbacks will always be among the first off the boards. Then you have those edge rushers like the Chase Youngs and the Boses, and those are the guys who sort of slip in at those very high picks. This year, of course, we're going to have Kyle Pitts, but that's an anomaly coming from a tight end. But you also, I think, still – we're at a point where if you have that devastating inside guy, the Quinnen Williams from a few years ago on defense, that's a guy who could conceivably be a top five pick. That's because those are rare, hard to find. You mentioned Leal, but he's more, you know, I don't know if he's not really an outside, an inside guy, that like typical defensive tackle, but is there,
right.
is there sort of that Quinnen Williams, that devastating inside guy you could see developing into a top 5 or 10 pick?
Man, it would be great to see Jordan Davis get back to what he was early at Georgia. DJ Dale at Alabama. Like, I mean, basically when you are an evaluator, you just look at Alabama's depth chart and if they're draft eligible, you put them on your list.
Yeah.
Right. So like, that's not a joke. It's to that point with Alabama. So I think DJ Dale is someone who not as big as Quinnen Williams, but could be, you know, again, a similar type of just, you know, difference maker on the interior, but there's not that standout player right now where you're like, we knew who Quinnen was, you know, we knew who Jonathan Allen was. There's not that player right now.
Okay. So when do you give me, so again, you're still grinding away for 2021, but you've already started on 2022. When do you hit your first 2022 mock?
Yeah, soon. I posted a schedule, which I got to hold myself to, which is why you do that, right? You put a schedule out, then you have to stick to it. So my first 2022 mock draft will drop May 5th. So I don't mess around with that. You know, especially now, you know, I'm an independent writer. You got to, you know, play to what your audience wants. And the audience said they want a mock draft next week or 2 weeks from now. So that's what they're going to get.
Excellent. Well, Matt, again, very happy to see you on TV, to see what you're doing with the Draft Scout. Follow Matt Miller at NFL Draft Scout on Twitter. He's a great follow. He provides a ton of content and information for draft Knicks. And appreciate you coming on here, squeezing me in at a really busy time, Matt. Thanks so much.
Yeah, of course. It's great to talk to you again, and we'll have to do this again soon.
No doubt. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. If you have questions that you'd like me or my guests to answer, email them to aptop25mailbag@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. That's aptop25mailbag@gmail.com. Next up on the podcast is my good friend, Nicole Auerbach from The Athletic. Thank you so much for joining me, Nicole. It's been a little while. I hope you and Red are doing well.
We are. And if anyone hears some squeaking in the background, that is my 10-pound Bichon Yorkie, Red.
Exactly. He is a fine, fine dog and a fine friend of mine. And sometimes he gets a little jealous when he's not on the podcast, too. So he makes his presence felt.
You invited him already as we were getting ready for this.
That's true.
In case it happens, you did ask him to come on.
That's a good point. He is always welcome. He is always welcome on this show. I just would prefer him to come in at opportune times. Let's put it that way. I want his contributions to be maximized as opposed to, just sort of here and there. So he's always welcome on the show, as are you. And so I appreciate you joining me, because last week there was a little bit of a Friday news dump that we were all in college football media trying to sort of analyze the tea leaves of what does this mean. But the college football playoff had its annual spring meeting last week of the commissioners who run the show, the management committee. And because, there's not a lot of reporters showing up to places to stalk these people like they usually would, like we usually would in normal times. Again, they sent out a press release, said, here's what we did this week. And it was a lot of normal blah, blah, blah. We're really happy with this. We're really satisfied with that. And then sort of burying the lead at the bottom of this press release is, oh, yeah. And by the way, we talked about models for expanding the format, or different models for the format. 63 different models ranging from 8 teams to 16 teams with all different kinds of locations and things like that. And we all were like, wow, that seems significant. So I asked you, Nicole, how significant?
It's a good question, because I think that is what we're trying to figure out. You and I were texting about this before we recorded this podcast, and I think that some of this is, okay, during the BCS era, it was forbidden to say the word playoff, right? And so what does it mean during the playoff era to be acknowledging expansion possibilities? I don't know about you, but I have felt that this has been trending in this direction for some time. I had a big story in The Athletic in January that was really about how frustrated everyone was with the current model. And I talked to all 10 commissioners who are on that committee, and they were talking about, okay, what does it mean that it's the same teams every year? And then the recruits only go to those teams, so the rich get richer. What does it mean in terms of audience for the playoff games? What about the fact that so many teams are essentially eliminated from the postseason before they even play a game? All of these kind of the side effects, and also, kind of the designed effects of this system. How are they working? How do people feel? Do people feel like it's the best for the sport? Is this healthy for the sport of college football? And a lot of people were saying no. And to me, that was the first time Greg Sankey, when in our conversation, said something like, is this what's best for the sport? I don't know. We need to look at different formats. And he's on this working group, which existed prior to this past week. To me, that marked a shift. I mean, I think we've all kind of been catching and noticing little signals and shifts over the last, again, I would say year, 2 years, maybe three, about frustration about the system. What does it mean to not have auto bids? What does it mean to have five Power Five leagues and only four spots, et cetera, et cetera? I think this acknowledgement that, here are the specific formats. They are 16, 18, 10 team, 12, 16. I think that definitely says something. It says, we're reading the room, we understand. And also, from my conversations with folks, this was a process that they planned to go through last spring, and then COVID happened. I don't think this is a process they wanted to do over Zoom. I think that the meeting that they have next in June in person in Chicago is significant, because they will be in person. They can have these conversations about the future of the playoff and how it works. But I don't know you know, to get to a consensus, to all agree on a specific model and a format and how much the bowls are going to be involved and what dates they're going to play. That's still a lot to ask. So it's definitely a step, but like that step to eventually get to like announcing here's what the format's going to look like. There's still so many intermediate pieces to get a lot of people on board. So I think it's a big deal that they acknowledged it. And again, I feel like it read the room. Like there's a push for an expanded playoff from a lot of folks in college administration, from a lot of coaches who believe it will be better for the sport. And the fans want that too. So I think it was acknowledging all of that, being trying to be somewhat proactive. I don't know if I would say fully proactive, but it was definitely surprising to see it acknowledged, because usually Bill Hancock, the executive director, is kind of like, no, no, everything's fine. This was the same in the BCS, until suddenly it wasn't. And it's like, here's our new thing. And everything is even going to be better now. And so it was an incremental step that I do think was buried, was a bit of a Friday news dump, and should continue this path towards eventually expanding this thing. We just don't know how big, and we just don't know if they're going to do it before the contract is up in 2025.
Right. So you mentioned incremental step, right? Incremental step is basically the way college sports tends to work. You can say, well, it's the way everything works. But yeah, I mean, the college sports tends to take these very sort of small, secure and safe incremental steps along the way, sort of signaling, hey, we're going to do this, but by the time we actually get around to doing this, it could be a while. Right. I mean, we've been dealing this with NIL, really. I mean, I know it's a different thing because the governance structure is very different for the NCAA than what it is with the college football playoff, which is basically run by the Power Five leagues with some input from the Group of Five. So it should be more nimble. But I just haven't necessarily. But A, incremental change is sort of the way college sports goes. And B, I still have not felt like. Things, you know, we have a great baseball writer here at the AP named Ron Blum, who covers the business side of baseball really, really well. And anytime something comes up with free agency or, you know, player contracts or maybe CBA stuff, he basically will always remind me, like, until there's a deadline, nobody acts, right? Like, people don't necessarily. And I think that that's an interesting sort of place to sort of take that thought and move it over into this discussion. I don't know if there's a lot of urgency to change this. There's 5 more years left in the ESPN deal. So the big question becomes, like, will they change it before the 5 years are up? Right. I think the assumption now is that after the 5 years are up, we'll definitely have a new format. But is this a signal that no, we would, as you said, now we're not sure about the answer here, but is this the first signal that maybe they'll do something before the 5 years are up? You know, if you want to, again, read tea leaves, the last 2 years of the 5 years that of the 12-year contract, they have not picked a championship game site yet. Now, does that matter? But does that matter?
Here are 2 quick questions, as like in terms of TV negotiations. When they announced the BCS was going to the CFP, how close were they to the end of a contract? Was it a deadline?
It wasn't. Well, they were 2 years. The playoff got put in place, if I remember, in 2011, or at least by 2011, they knew they were going to have a playoff, and then it was a matter of working out details. And then the last CFP or the last BCS season was 2013.
Yeah, the official announcement of, like, this is what's going to look like was in summer of 2012. So, but we did know that it was coming. That was. We know it's going to be a 4-team playoff.
Yeah. So there was a little bit of like, hey, like we this is coming, but we're still going to ride out what we have because we're kind of locked into this for a couple of years. So I guess that's a long-winded way of me saying, like, I still feel like we could be in that phase of by the time they really ramp this thing up of like knocking out details. Now, all of a sudden, there's 2 or 3 years left on the contract, and then you're riding, like, basically lame ducking it for a couple of years. Before you make a transition, like, I just don't sense a lot of urgency on to get this done. Now, maybe last year's terrible ratings for the TV prompted a little more urgency. But again, this is all super speculative.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. I mean, I feel like for the last year, I've been trying to figure that out. Like, A, can you get out of this contract ahead of time? And the answer is always, if both sides are motivated to, yes.
Yes, right.
B, will the pandemic and the financial crunch affect this and the potential urgency? Maybe. But then also, like, someone put it to me this way last week. Well, if this was something I kind of wanted to do a year ago or been thinking about, looking at a format, doing kind of like a wholesale evaluation, well, then the pandemic happened. Now you're a year closer to the end of the contract now. So it's sort of like, again, you could continue moving in a slow but, you know, kind of, I guess, strategic, but more just like an ultimately direct way. To me, I just don't know yet if there is enough. And that's been the question for the last couple of years. Can you do this before the contract is up? And will you do it before the contract is up? But we've even seen, I mean, you've seen program scheduling for post 2026 in a way that they're like, well, this is going to help us in an 18 playoff or, you know, 16 team playoff, whatever. We're going to have all these big non-conference games. So like, I totally agree with you. There's the assumption that it will be at the end of the contract, if not sooner. So we'll see. I mean, again, I think, you know, it's potentially going to be really interesting when this group of commissioners and the Notre Dame athletic director get together in June. And they kind of hash this out. You sit in a room and say, like, if this isn't working, are we ready to jump through all the hoops to change it before 5 seasons from now? I don't know. I really wonder. I keep thinking about this, about like making it a 12-year contract in the first place. And I know that part of that is obviously to commit to the system, commit to a playoff and not be like, oh, if it goes badly for 1 year, we're just going to go back to the BCS or whatever. But man, 12 years feels like a really long time.
But that was really important back then because the BCS was constantly under attack. And really one of the things that they've done over the first bunch of years, I mean, you can Nicole, you don't realize this because you're younger than us. So you weren't covering it when some of us old guys were covering it when it switched. I think you were still in college. But the BCS was getting crushed constantly, right? And I think when they switched over to the playoff, and you'll notice this because you've covered this part of it, like they're always very positive. Like I my sense is the people who defend the playoff, or they don't want to be on their heels defending it. Like I think part of the reason why the BCS crumbled and became problematic is because it was starting to get attacked from within. So you'll always notice just the language of the CFP defense is the language around the CFP tends to be a lot more positive. Like, we're very happy with this. This is going well. And I think part of that is because they didn't want to create some of the negative space that they found themselves in with the BCS, where it was just constant negativity, and then people were sniping at it from within. So I think that they've been pretty good at creating some of this like positive consensus around the CFP, which helps prop it up, even though now foundationally some of that is crumbling.
I think the best way to think of that is everyone will always say, hey, 4 is still better than 2. This is still better than what we had. But,
right. They definitely have that going for them.
And that's the conversation with a lot of people. But that also means that it's still, if you do believe that 4 is better than 2, where is that urgency? Is it there to change it before there's that natural period of negotiation with your TV partner? That's the big question. That's the thing to monitor. Again, over this next month and a half, but especially just moving forward, it's like, is there that sense of urgency to rip up a contract and redo this? And again, there's a lot of reasons to do it. And people are definitely not pleased with the fact that it's the same teams every single year, and that there's a lot of teams and coaches that just feel completely left out when the season starts, and the way that the sport is viewed through this prism. And I don't think anyone necessarily thought we'd be talking about like, oh, the Pac-12, like one league can't make this thing every year. And like, they've only been in X amount of these things. Like there's been some framing in the way that we think about the sport that is different. Like, do we still celebrate? Like, it felt unusual that we celebrated and got BYU Coastal last year, because for so long, there's been like 3 games on the calendar we circle that matter for the playoff picture. And that's all we talk about all year long. And I think that there's some elements of like the weirdness of college football and the love for so many different levels of it that are serious fundamental questions and concerns about like, what do you want this postseason to be for your sport? And they will need to answer those. So it's like, it's kind of an interesting conversation because I know everyone gets, you know, excited about expansion and the different formats and we'll talk about them too, but it's ultimately like this big picture question of like, what should the postseason of this sport, which is very unique, very regional, what should it be? Who should it serve? What should it look like?
Okay, so yeah, let's have some fun with this. So what, because I do this because this is who I am, like on the back of a napkin all the time. Like I will, like when I find myself like my mind wandering and I have nothing in there, just start jotting down like, could you do 8? Could you do 12? Like 8's pretty easy, but how could you do 8? What about 16? No, that seems too big. 6 teams is too small. Can I get buys in here? So when you like just for fun sort of come up with ideas, the 8, 5 automatic bids plus a G5 automatic, 2 wild cards, that's sort of like the standard, I think, like default model that everybody sort of assumes, like, well, that could work. But have you come up with any other things, any other models and formats that you think, oh, this could be fun?
I think that when I think about expansion and people talk about it, I do think of that model that you just described, which is auto bids for the Power Five champions, a group of 5 champion spot, and 2 at large, because I think it serves a lot of the it addresses a lot of the weaknesses in the current system. And I think engages people in conference races, conference championships down the stretch in a way that doesn't happen now in November. I think that you mentioned being interested in buys. And now that I think of that a little bit more, I like it because it is a grueling season. I do think you need to figure out ways to reward the best teams. And I think of teams like Gonzaga in the West Coast Conference, and they get basically like, it's like a double or triple buy, I'm not even sure what it is anymore, into like the West Coast Conference semis. And like, is that fair? Sure. They're the best team in the league by far every year. But also just like, why wouldn't you want to protect your best team when you're in a smaller league or something and you want to make sure that they get that bid? I think there should be benefits for, you know, having a great regular season. We talk about wear and tear a lot. So, I mean, I think of some of these models, you're going to have to ask, like, how many extra games are you adding or how are you spacing them out? But I do think having a bye is a great reward and a way to add the number, like, so to get more teams to say that they made the playoff, but not add a game.
It also, I think, creates an opportunity to avoid some, because we complain a lot, like now, the 1-4-2-3 provides a lot of blowouts because basically we've gotten to a point now where college football is sort of dominated by some super teams. And if you look at the recruiting rankings, like you really are getting, you know, I've had this crazy idea of like it's becoming a little like basketball in that professional basketball, like the best recruits are all going to the same couple of schools and creating these like super teams. If you just go by the recruiting rankings with Alabama and Ohio State and Clemson and probably Georgia sort of on the outskirts of that, maybe Oklahoma comparative to the rest of the Big 12. So if you want to avoid, if you want to take those super teams and say, okay, sit aside for now, because we kind of know that you guys are the best teams anyway and probably going to win this thing. But let's put you aside for now and let the teams that are a little closer, like I think 4 and 10 are a lot closer than many years than 1 and 4. So maybe we put the super teams aside, give them a bye, and we create some really interesting quarterfinals and semifinals before we get the super teams involved, or at least quarterfinals before we get the super teams involved in the semifinals. Now, of course, fans will say, well, if you know which teams are going to win, why do you need to let more teams in? I am so not down with that and not here for that argument. It's about creating interesting TV products, and it's about creating more opportunities for more teams, as you said, to be interested in games down the stretch. We are getting to the point where November ends up being almost a little boring in college football. So I am not down with that argument, but I do wonder if you can create some buys, you will end up with some more competitive quarterfinal games before you get to the big boys.
I think the lack of competitive games in the semifinals has been a huge, huge issue. There are so few that have been decided by one score that we could, you know, can list them off if we wanted to. And I think that's been a big problem because you talk about TV ratings, you talk about a compelling product, but you also talk about the way that we look at the regular season. Every year we're starting from the point of who's going to be the fourth team. We pencil teams in. That's not great. That's not healthy. And I think that the point of adding more spots, even if you think that the final destination is the same and it might still be Alabama-Clemson, is to make it more interesting along the way and to have access points.
Right.
And so,
agreed.
Like, even if it's eight, even if you do play that game, you play a 1-8 game and it's Alabama versus UCF and it's a blowout. Hey, you know what? I'm still glad UCF had a chance to decide that on the field. Like, I still think it's interesting. I still think it's worthwhile. And what I'll say, too, is one thing that I thought of this past year when you looked at the semifinals was, okay, there's some teams that got hotter at the end of the year, like Oklahoma. You have an expanded playoff, and you have a couple, you have an extra round, or like you described, you know, you kind of give a bye to the top four teams or whatever it might be. Maybe one of those super teams gets a hotter team to play. And maybe that gives us a better game in a semifinal round. Because right now, you know, we've seen teams, this was the first year we had a team that lost its last regular season game in a conference championship game and made the playoff. That's not necessarily, like, were they playing, was Notre Dame playing their best football season at the end of the season? I don't think so. So it's like, you could, if you have more of a playoff, like you think about, again, March Madness, I keep thinking about that because that's the best postseason and that regular season has a huge, lots of issues, but the postseason is good because the best team doesn't always win. It's the hottest team. The team that can win six games wins a national championship. Not to say that that's going to happen in football, that like an eight seed is going to go on a tear. It is hard. It is physical. You need to be like athletic and physical enough to win these games. But if you have more teams, more access where you're not eliminating Oklahoma in September and a team that gets better through the years and gets hotter through the years, might give you a better game at the end when Alabama needs an opponent, right? So that's another reason, I think, from an excitable fan standpoint, to want more teams and more access points so that teams that had one bad game in September don't get immediately eliminated, even if you think they're playing their best ball at the end of the year and could have given an Alabama, a Clemson, whoever, a better game.
Yeah, so it's the one reason why all these things that we're sort of picking into, when they came out and said, we looked at 6 and 10 and 8 and 12, like 16 seems like a bridge too far, and 6 doesn't quite seem like enough because I think you're still boxing yourself into having – I don't think it's a given that the group of 5 will have a spot. I think they're going to have to work for that. And what I mean by that is like Oresco and some of the other commissioners are going to have to – are going to have to make a stink. Now, I think that there is enough, they can raise enough hell and frankly, maybe even threaten enough lawsuits that they will get their spot, but I don't think it's going to come easy. So again, 6 becomes a little small because then also you're looking at like, if I'm the SEC, I'm thinking immediately, no, I want to make sure I have 2 in this thing every year. Like, oh, if we're gonna expand this thing, I'm in the best position to get 2. So I want to make sure the structure allows me to get 2. But I guess this is me saying 8 seems like the logical next step, and the way we set it up, that again, 5-1-2. But I could, because of some of these other things, the idea of creating buys and more opportunities and all these other possibilities make me wonder if 8 is almost, maybe there is another step beyond 8. Maybe there's a way you can do it beyond 8. I said college sports likes incremental steps, and the incremental step would be 8. But I do wonder if when they start moving the pieces on the board here and asking a bunch of questions, the answers to those questions come back, oh, maybe we need more than that.
Yeah, and that's why I think seeing 10 and 12 listed was really interesting, because I do think the only real round of buys that have been in the public conversation has really been like a 6-team format, because you've had coaches argue for that, right? You've had like people bring that up. If it goes to 16, let's say, because we're playing in all these hypotheticals anyway.
Sure, what the hell?
Would you? How would you structure a 16?
A 16 would be, gosh, I almost have to like now get my pen in, because I hadn't done that one. You can do double buys, though, in a 16, couldn't you?
I think so, but I mean more so to the point of here's a question you could ask. And again, this
I think I know where you're going with this. Okay.
Yeah, a little bit. Who has enough power at this table, right?
Yeah, I gotcha.
You have 10 football playing conferences at the FBS level.
Right.
Do you have a designated spot for each conference?
If you're going to go to 16, that would be the way to do it. Now, there's a lot of good reasons for that. And some would tell you that if everybody had access to the playoff, that would raise the profile of those conferences and help them bridge some of the resource and talent gap between the especially the lower group of five. Let's say what it is. It's Conference USA, the MAC, and the Sun Belt. As great as the Sun Belt was last year, resource-wise, it is way, way, way behind the Power Five. At least the Mountain West and the AAC can kind of see the Power Five off in the distance. Those other three really can't. Do you give access to all of them? I mean, again, realistically, it would raise their profile, so maybe it helps them bridge that gap. But I also think, again, being super realistic here, I don't know if it does it enough. And then are we just putting these teams in and placing them in positions where they're constantly getting blown out in the first round? If you're doing 1-16, 2-15, 3-14, like those are okay. Those type of blowouts can get sort of like we tolerate them in basketball because there are so many other games going on. But when you're one of only 8 games and 3 of them are blowouts, you know, that's tough, right?
And that's what I wonder, again, because right now in the system, the way it's set up, you have these conferences have seats at the table. Like, they're part of this. And I do wonder if you go to 16, do you let them have a seat? Do you truly start the season by saying every single 130 teams, well, I guess like 126, whatever, without the independents, truly have a chance to make this thing? I don't know. I mean, because again, part of this is about keeping people engaged through the season and having access points. I would be fascinated to be a fly on the wall if it's a 16 conversation about that particular question. Because otherwise, is the SEC going to get like 4 teams in this? Probably. Like, you know, like, are you going to get all these, you know, the teams, the leagues that we think are the best are going to get a bunch of teams in? Sure. But I'd be fascinated to see how this plays out. And again, the models, because I do think you've definitely turned me around a little bit on some of these buys, because the 10 and the 12s in particular could be really interesting. And also, again, the wear and tear of the athlete is going to be part of this conversation. And I think that you're able to add games, add teams engaged because they're making the playoff. And also, if you have 12 teams make this thing, then, you know, are we talking about 30 teams through November? You know, like, how many teams are we engaging in this conversation instead of right now when we only talk about like 6 teams the entire season?
Right.
You can do all of those things and not add the wear and tear for like the, you know, the 20 Alabama NFL prospects, right? If you have a bye. So that's what's, I think I'm coming around on that a little bit. I've definitely drawn on napkins at a bar about some of this stuff, but have mostly focused on 8 and the arguments about the different ways to structure 8. So I do like that by listing the different numbers, they are opening our eyes to larger than 8, because I think there are some potentially interesting formats. But it is all really hypothetical. It is all theorizing, but that's really what college football fans do best.
Yes, it absolutely is. And we haven't even talked about where they're going to play these games and you know, home sites or different bowls and things along those lines, and which honestly would almost be a whole nother podcast. And I heard in the background, you can tell Red has grown up in Big Ten country, because as soon as you mentioned the SEC putting 4 teams in, I could kind of hear him whimpering a little bit.
I think. Yes, he... He is, he's Michigan by blood, and also now lives in Chicago. So he's a Big Ten country dog. So he's not pleased. I mean, we'll see. If I say Ohio State, do we have anything?
Well, but he grew up in the New York area. Clearly, Rutgers, right?
That's true. That's
He's also got Rutgers in his family, right? His brother, right?
Didn't
your brother, his brother, or her go to Rutgers?
Rutgers. He's really excited about the Greg Schiano hire.
Yeah, he's all about New York's Big Ten team.
Big Ten team. You know, basically, from what I'm told, they're right on, you know, the water, the Hudson. So, based on all the imagery I see.
Exactly. Without question. So, yeah, listen, this is going to be fun and fascinating. And, again, I think ultimately, you know, again, did they tease us on Friday and sort of say, hey, this is coming soon? Or did they sort of just say, we're acknowledging this is happening and we'll get back to you and don't hold your breath. But eventually we're going to sort of muddle through this. Hard to tell. We'll be here to try to update you all, listeners, over the next month or so to get an idea of where this is all heading. But, you know, if nothing else, it made for some good off-season content, Nicole.
Which, again, we appreciate. We love hypotheticals in college football.
And, hey, last word, considering what last season's off-season content, if there was an off-season, it's all good, man. Just bring it all on. Bring all this speculative stuff and what we're going to do with the playoff and, you know, whether Texas should play Texas A&M and should Auburn move to the SEC East. I'm for it all last year compared to what we had to deal with. All for it this year compared to what we had to deal with last year.
Preach, preach. Yes, I would much rather talk about adding playoff games than whether or not we're going to have a season. So, yes, 100% agree.
All right, Nicole Auerbach from The Athletic, thank you very much for joining me today. Red, thank you so much for contributing to the show, and hopefully we'll get to do this again. Maybe we'll even see each other in person real soon, Nicole. Who knows? How about that?
Well, I don't know how I'll react, so I cannot apologize. I'm going to apologize in advance for however... You know, I might try to go for a hug, then realize we're not supposed to do that. Maybe a handshake, maybe a fist bump, elbow bump.
Yeah.
Who knows? But yes, hopefully that's the case. And thanks for having me.
Thanks, Nicole. And now, 3 and out. First down. It seems like it has been a surprisingly positive offseason for Michigan. Jim Harbaugh brought in a bunch of new, young, and intriguing coaches. He overhauled his recruiting staff, and the Wolverines signed a pretty nice 2021 class, despite a really terrible season. Well, that last one took a hit recently. Xavier Worthy, a 4-star receiver from California, said he was leaving Michigan. Worthy then committed very quickly to Texas during the Longhorns' spring game last weekend. Good get for Steve Sarkisian. We tend to overreact to all things Michigan and Harbaugh, so I'll try not to do that here. But related to Michigan's well-chronicled quarterback issues under Harbaugh is the fact that it has really wasted some pretty good receiver talent in recent years as well. On one hand, you watch Michigan and think it doesn't seem like there are a lot of high-end skill position players here. On the other hand, Donovan Peoples-Jones was a huge recruit who showed some potential in his rookie year with Cleveland after being a 6th-rounder. And NFL teams seem to like the upside of Nico Collins in this year's draft. Another former Michigan receiver in this year's draft class is Tariq Black. He played his final season at Texas last year. Black was a big-time recruit in the same class as Peoples-Jones. There were some injury issues, but that's another 4-star who never developed at Michigan. The loss of Worthy and Giles Jackson, yet another 4-star, albeit a lower 4-star guy, who Michigan failed to develop and transferred out, leaves the Wolverines with Ronnie Bell and Cornelius Johnson as the top targets heading into this year. Bell is very good, but I don't think of him as a game-breaking receiver, certainly not a guy who, when you look at some of the top guys in this class, the Jamar Chases, the guys who are potential first-rounders, I don't think Bell is that. Johnson is a rangy receiver with good upside, but again, probably not among that elite class of receiver. In the golden age of wide receivers, when that position is often what separates the good teams from the championship contenders, Michigan needs to do better than what it has done. And to do better than what it has done and do better than what it has now, it has to prove quickly to players like Xavier Worthy that coming to Ann Arbor is a path to the upper rounds of the NFL draft and not a detour. Second down, we'll wrap up the draft talk with an annual tradition of mine, giving you a handful of my guys. Players who are very unlikely to be drafted in the first round, probably not even the second round, but I think will have pretty nice NFL careers. There are just so many receivers in this draft, but one that I personally have seen play a lot of really good games is Marquez Stevenson of Houston. I think he probably lands in the fourth, fifth, maybe even sixth round. He's not real big at 5'10 and maybe a 185, but he is a blazer who could turn into a deep threat and a really effective return man. I'm thinking a best case scenario for Stevenson is a role similar to Mecole Hardman of Kansas City. He becomes a third or fourth option on a really good offense that could use him in a multitude of ways. He is a big play receiver with great acceleration. So keep an eye out for Marquez Stevenson. Another guy I like going to the running backs, I could see a scenario 2 or 3 years from now in which Trey Sermon, who had a late season breakout at Ohio State, is as productive as any of the potential first round backs in this class. But the late round back that I have my eye on with tons of upside, I think, is Kylan Hill from Mississippi State. He runs a little angry, and I love that. Plus, he has shown some value as a pass catcher. Third down, on the defensive side of the ball, those highly productive run-stopping linebackers who get a lot of pub in college generally become late-round picks in the NFL, where value is determined by what you can do on passing downs. Right now, I'm seeing Iowa's Nick Neiman as a guy who probably goes around the sixth round, but he's got some speed and athleticism that makes me think he could develop into a player who stays on the field enough to be a good starting linebacker for a long time in the league. The last player is maybe my favorite. USC safety Talanoa Hufanga was crazy productive and all over the field when you watched him play. His problem is measurables. Not that big, and he's not that fast. So what is he in the NFL if you can't drop him deep and let him be a center fielder type safety because of his 4.6 speed, and you can't play him close to the line like a linebacker hybrid because he's only about 200 pounds? The NFL is a league of big, strong, and fast. Toughness and instincts can only go so far if they are not supplemented by one, if not all three of those things. Hufanga projects as a fourth or fifth rounder, but I think if you get him in the right defense and he becomes a little more disciplined as a tackler, you could have a Tyrann Mathieu light type defender. If nothing else, a guy who becomes a terror on special teams. That is the show for today. I'd like to thank my producer, John Radcliffe, for making me sound good. You can find this podcast at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, appodcast.com, just about anywhere you like to get your pods. Please subscribe so you do not miss an episode. If you have questions that you'd like me or my guests to answer, email them to aptop25mailbag@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you on all topics college football, serious or silly. That's aptop25mailbag@gmail.com. I'm Ralph Russo, the college football writer with the Associated Press. Thanks for listening, and come back for more next week of the AP Top 25 College Football Podcast.